First of all, let me grab the pointer. It's this one, right? So this is it's a picture taken from the husband of the postdoc who made most of this work, Sonia Albini. And this is the square at the center of Rome. It's a very busy square at the Stazione Termini, the station train in Rome. And it's so busy in the night for different purposes than in the day, because the train station is closed, that all the cars take several directions. So remind a little bit the fate of human embryonists themselves, which can take a lot of directions. And on the nighttime, without anyone order them, they are confused. So this kind of confusion can be used by, at least by scientists, to actually provide the way to direct embryonists themselves for different purposes. In the case of neuromuscular disease, it is very important to have available the generation of muscles from human embryonists themselves, essentially from two different perspectives: to obtain an unlimited generation of muscle progenitors that can be transplanted for the treatment of neuromuscular disease, but more for our purpose, to provide something that doesn't exist yet, which is the three-dimensional contractile structure suitable for in this model of neuromuscular disease. So right now, as we stand, there is not available model, three-dimensional contracting model of skeletal muscles. And this actually prevents the use of contractile 3D skeletal muscles to model certain disease and discover drugs for this disease. And the one bottleneck on this is the idea of achieving a 3D structure that can undergo contraction. So our question was, how can we instruct human embryonic stem cells to form three-dimensional contracted skeletal muscles and for miniaturized myofibers for in this disease modeling? And a very important concept, a very important transition, is the formation of the mesoderm. So normally we obtain, other scientists have obtained skeletal muscle cells starting from human embryonic stem cells that already transitioned through the mesoderm. But this clearly limits the possibility to obtain an homogeneous population of stem cells that can cluster and form a human embryonic, and form a sort of a contracting muscle. So the big question mark is how to convert stem cells, human embryonic stem cells, into muscle progenitors, let them cluster into embryo-like bodies that instead of forming three lineages would uniformly form skeletal muscles that would likely generate contractile myofibers. So the first question to address here is whether the typical myogenic conversion that occurs invariably in most of the somatic tissues, as described by Harold Weintraub probably 30 years ago, and by which fibroblast ectopically expressing myoD can be converted in skeletal myotubes. Can this process be also observed in human embryonic stem cells? So Sonia Albini decided to address this by comparing the conversion of human fibroblast and human embryonic stem cells. And the answer is very straightforward. The conversion that typically occurs in fibroblasts does not occur in human embryonic stem cells. So we've been wondering for a while what was the reason for this resistance of human embryonic stem cells. And while screening a number of epigenetic modifiers, we noticed that a very important component of the chromatin remodeling complex, the Swi-SNF chromatin remodeling complex, BAS66, was selectively absent in three of our human embryonic stem line, H1, H7, and H9, where it's clearly present in fibroblasts that get converted by myotube. So why SNF chromatin remodeling complex? It's a critical complex to remodel the chromatin at the myogenic loci in order to activate transcription, muscle-specific gene expression. And this has been discovered by us and by Imbalsano's group about 10 years ago, showing that the recruitment of the whole complex by MyoD is required for MyoD-dependent activation of gene expression. And BAT66 is one of the many structural, non-enzymatic components of this complex. Later on, we described that BAT66, it's actually very important to form a bridge between the enzymatic compartment, the enzymatic subunits of this SNF complex and MyoD. BAT66 can be present together with MyoD at the myogenic loci prior the recruitment of the rest of the enzymatic competent SNF complex, which is stimulated by the activation of this kinase. This is a p38 alpha kinase, which is normally activated upon regeneration stimuli, and by phosphorylating threonine in BAT66 allows the recruitment of the enzymatic components of the SNF complex, thereby activating transcription. So here is clearly shown that BAT66 is expressed in most of the somatic tissues, but it's not expressed in human embryonic stem cells. And the expression of BAT66, which tends to occur along with the formation of the embryonic bodies, correlates with the competence of embryonic bodies to get converted by MyoD. So the most straightforward experiment Sonia did was to see whether co-expression of BAT66 could actually enable MyoD to activate skeletal myogenesis in human embryonic stem cells. And the answer was yes, although it wasn't so striking. You see here the difference between MyoD without and MyoD with BAT66. So still not comparable to the efficiency that we observe in fibroblasts, but this experiment clearly told us that BAT66 was an important component for MyoD to activate skeletal myogenesis in human embryonic stem cells. The second step, very important transition that Sonia decided to address, was whether maybe clustering these cells into structures that mimic the embryonic body could provide the signal. So what she did is to set up an entire protocol starting from two infections with lentivirus BAT66, MyoD, aggregate these cells that contain both BAT66 and MyoD into floating clusters, assuming that this floating cluster may actually provide signals that give the competence of the complex to assist MyoD-mediated gene expression. And then dissociate the embryoid bodies, these kind of aggregates, let's call them aggregates, and see whether once they are dissociated, they are formed mainly by skeletal muscle cells. And this was the case. As you can see, only upon the expression of BAT66 and MyoD, most of these floating clusters were formed by cells that upon dissociation could form myosin heavy chain positive myotubes, supporting the idea that BAT66 is the key epigenetic factor that provides the competence for MyoD-mediated activation in H9. But we wanted to take this opportunity to see whether this kind of clusters made by sort of myogenic committed human embryonic stem cells, if left aggregated, could form the 3D structures I was referring before. So what Sonia did was to do exactly the same protocol, but rather than dissociating the embryoid bodies, she was keeping the floating embryoid bodies, and after she tested several media, she came up with an insulin-containing medium that is typically considered the muscle differentiation medium. And then she performed the staining after 15 days. So what was the fate of these cells? Well, While normal cells without myoid D or Ba6TC tend to form the embryoid bodies, with myoid D, the embryoid bodies had a little bias towards cardiomyogenesis. But with myoid D and Ba6TC, all the embryoid bodies gave rise to myofibers that clustered together into 3D structures that later on we observed to be actually, let's see if it works. It doesn't work every day, but today is a good day. So as you can see, these kind of structures were not only formed by myofibers, but were also provided with the ability to contract. And the contraction, well, the dissociation still shows that those are skeletal muscles rather than cardiac muscle cells. But also the contraction type was clearly discriminating these myospheres from what is typically calcium transient of cardiomyocytes. So this was a protocol for formation of a three-dimensional skeletal muscles from urine embryonic stem cells, but wasn't enough to provide an indish disease modeling. We needed to jump into the iPS cells. So what Sonia did was to use the human embryonic stem cells and the iPS cells in parallel and check whether from the iPS cells we can actually recapitulate the same process, and the answer was yes. The efficiency is now much higher because she decided to move into a pigback at the Sleeping Beauty transposon activated myoid D Ba6TC system, which allows way more potent gene expression. All the cells express the myoid D and Ba6TC. And when she used the same technology to form the myospheres, she was able to actually recapitulate the same process and generate contractile 3D myospheres from IPS of normal patients, normal individuals, but also from Duchenne muscular dystrophy patients. And here is exactly where we are going. So we're trying to use patient-derived cells, IPS cells, convert them into these 3D contracted structures and see whether after contraction, when most of the pathogenesis becomes evident, we can actually recapitulate salient features of disease and possibly use this technology for a personalized discovery of not only unknown pathogenic events, but also therapeutic opportunity. So, since we are very interested in translational medicine, but by background, by primary interest, we are still very much fascinated by epigenetics and molecular biology, we decided to use this conversion of human embryonic stem cells, or iPS cells, to investigate from an epigenetic standpoint human skeletal myogenesis, which is still kind of not fully investigated. And we use this to understand how the epigenetic landscape can allow myogenic conversion in the presence of Ba6TC, but not when myoid D is expressed alone. So the question was even more intriguing when considering that myoid D, which does not activate skeletal myogenesis in human embryonic stem cells, it's actually supposed to bind pervasively the human embryonic stem cells, given the fact that in the pluripotent cells, human embryonic stem cells as an epigenetic landscape that should be permissive for master transcription factor DNA binding. So the first question was, does myoid D bind or not the E-box, which is the consensus binding site, human embryonic stem cells? And we decided to approach this by chromatin immunoprecipitation for myoid D and the RNA-seq to understand whether the myoid D genome-wide binding pattern has a transcriptional output different depending on whether Ba6TC was expressed or not. The chipseq for MyOD was giving a sort of an, well, I would say expected by us results. So MyOD alone, which is this, clearly binds way more loci, way more genomic regions than in the presence of BAS6CC. There were some binding sites that were overlapping between MyOD and MyOD BAS6CC, but clearly the ability of MyOD to bind the DNA was superior in the absence of BAS6CC. What was the transcriptional output? So we investigated by RNA-seq the transcription output two stages in undifferentiated and EB day number 5. And as you can see at the very beginning, actually MyOD BAS6TC can modulate gene expression much better. But later on, this massive pervasive binding of MyOD results in a much higher transcriptional output. So what is the quality of gene expression upon MyOD binding with or without BAS6TC? As you can see here, we have a BAS6TC alone, BAS6TC MyOD, and MyOD alone, undifferentiated and EB day 5. And you can see clearly that in the absence of BAS6TC, MyOD has a much better ability to activate gene expression at both stages. And the gene expression is clearly not only skeletal muscles. You can see the activation of neurogenesis, cardiogenesis, and other non-muscle lineages. While in the presence of BAS6TC, most of the transcription is repressed. And the only transcription that is still active, it's only the differentiation of skeletal muscles, indicating that BAS6TC somehow narrows down the ability of MyOD to productively bind muscle loci. And as a matter of fact, when we investigated the fate of cells that express only MyOD, we could see features of cardiac and neurogenesis in addition to some sporadic activation of skeletal myogenesis. So the neurogenesis is especially important when you consider a very interesting paper from Tapscott that came out a couple of years ago. So both MyOD and NeuroD can recognize the E-box. However, there are some E-box that are shared by the two factors, which normally activate general features of differentiation. And then it discriminated by a ChIP-seq experiment, a private E-box where the denucleotide is GG for MyOD, specific for skeletal myogenesis. And the private E-box where the denucleotide is GA, which correlates with neuro-D-mediated activation of gene expression, neural gene expression. So when we went to distinguish these two different type of binding, we found that actually the ability of BAS6TC to impose binding that is MyOD private was 53% versus the 36% of ability of MyOD alone to recognize this private binding site, indicating that BAS6TC can actually impose a preferential binding to this myogenic specific E-box. So just some ChIP-seq data to show that, for instance, there are some common genes which are bound by MyOD in the absence or in the presence of BAS6TC. There are other genes, skeletal muscle genes, that are bound only by MyOD and BAS6TC, ACTA1. And this is probably because by, a FAIR, which I don't have the time to explain, but you should just believe me, it's an essay where every time you see this situation means that the nucleosomes are remodeled. The chromatin is more permissive for transcription. So the chromatin remodeling is clearly stimulated only in the presence of BAS6TC on certain myogenic loci, and this results in a preferential recruitment of polymerase 2 and, of course, elongation on the coding gene of polymerase 2. But more interestingly, see here, you see that there are certain neurogenic genes which are only bound by MyoD in the absence of BAS6TC. While when BAS6TC was introduced together with MyoD, it prevented the binding of MyoD to neurogenic sites. So we believe that one of the job of BAS6TC is to prevent this illegitimate pervasive MyoD binding to a non-myogenic e-box. And this is our model. So in the absence of BAS6TC, MyoD pervasively bind most of the genome in human embryonic stem cells, giving rise to productive and non-productive binding on non-muscle e-box and some shared box, which justifies the ability of MyoD to activate several lineages which are driven by e-box. While in the presence of BAS6TC, MyoD gets stick to its natural target genes and can activate muscle transcription, specific muscle transcription, possibly by opening up the chromatin, recruited the polymerase II, and promote skeletal myogenesis. I want to give full credit for this to Sonia Albini, who spent 5 years moving the project along and made an exceptional work, but also with the help of Paola Coutinho, Alessandra Dalagnese, and Sole Gatto, who analyzed all the bioinformatic data. Thank you for the attention. Be happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much, Lorenzo. That was great. Maybe in the interest of time, we have time for maybe just one question. Sure.
Great talk, Lorenzo. NeuroD also important in pancreas, in addition to nervous system. So those MyoD cross-binding to the sites, there was a neural or pancreatic NeuroD binding sites. And is there any preference if there is?
We don't know about the preference, but what we notice is that by gene ontology, we observed features of pancreatic differentiation. I don't know whether this is related to the ability to bind e-box that are normally bound by NeuroD or not, but we have observed features of, well, kind of genes that belong to the pancreatic lineage activated by MyoD alone. We have never tested the expression of pancreatic genes in H9 expressing MyoD, which is something we should probably do.
Very good. Have you taken a similar approach of these spheroids getting at satellite cells, for example, instead of a myoblast or myotube type?
That was a great interest. We got a student that was fully engaged on this project. And we do have evidence that there are some PAX7 positive cells. But whether these cells are actually satellite cells and whether these myospheres can actually recapitulate the muscle environment
with
the niche, it's still to define, and we do not have any conclusive evidence for this.
Okay.